Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy using your member number at the snack bar, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT_golf guy. And today, today I get to have the discussions that I've been dying to have for a month about the Hall of Fame. It's current inductees and who deserves to get in and who doesn't. And should it be the Hall of Fame or the Hall of Achievement? And I get to have these discussions with two of my favorite voices in golf. Golf historian and Golf Channel broadcasting pioneer Peter Kessler. But we begin with a past recipient of the PGA's Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism, Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com. Ron, before we get started talking about the Hall of Fame, a premise, you've spent so much time on the Golf Channel these days, you're starting to think like a television producer. The premise that you have written about on your site this week and brought up is one of the great all-time bonehead arguments that you hear in every golf locker room, pro shop, and grill in America. And that is a bunch of guys who are low handicaps to scratch golfers sitting around going, yeah, I could take out those LPGA golfers. No way.
Yeah, you know, I get that. A lot of times when I write about the LPGA or women's golf in general, I get people on social media weighing in saying, oh, I'm a 3 handicap and I could kick their butts. So my idea for a TV show is let's have a contest. Let's pick 3 men who have a handicap at five or below, and pair them up with an average LPGA player, and play under tournament conditions with galleries, gallery ropes, TV cameras, and green set up to tournament speed and rough, and go out there and play. Because I think one of the things, these guys, there's 2 things they're not taking into consideration. And one is the choke factor.
Yeah, no, these ladies make putts for a living.
Yeah, that's why my idea is to this be a 36-hole tournament, because I'd love these guys to go home after the first round and see what people are saying about them on social media.
Yes!
You know, like, you know, and have to deal with what players put up with. The other thing is, you know, say somebody's a 2.7 gin index, you know. Well, you know, a handicap established on your Saturday morning skins game isn't exactly how you're going to perform in tournament situations. The numbers that I've had given to me by somebody who had access to them in a study that was done by the PGA Tour, the LPGA, and the USGA showed that men in tournament conditions, playing in the World Amateur Handicap Tournament at Myrtle Beach, people with zero handicaps, anywhere from 0 to a 5 handicap, averaged 82.3. What that tells me is you put that 4 handicap into a tournament situation, and all of a sudden he's a 10 handicap.
Well, and not only that, but gin numbers are usually established on a course that you play all the time. If you're the member at a club, you're playing that course all the time. These ladies are traveling all over the world playing different courses every week. To use a trite expression, their handicap travels a lot better than your handicap travels.
And even though they're not supposed to, a lot of these guys on their handicaps have some 2 or 3 footers that are just given to them, you know?
Yep. No,
and
no
if you're
question.
Playing in a tournament, believe me, there's nothing. 72 holes of stroke play. The couple of times that I've played under those situations, 72 holes of stroke play is a grind, man. You can't finish a hole with your golf ball in your pocket, you know? You gotta keep hitting it till it gets into that cup, and that's a drain, man. All of a sudden, those 2-foot putts feel like 8-foot putts.
Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com is our guest taking dead aim. Before we move off of this subject, the one argument that I hear echoing in the back of my head from people is, yeah, but what if we stretched it out and we played it at 7,200 yards? And I've had the fortune of playing in an LPGA pro-am with someone who was a Solheim Cup member. I've played on the Symetra Tour pro-ams twice with someone who is now on the LPGA Tour. And what I can tell you about both of those ladies is they were as deadly with their hybrid and fairway woods, and both of them could get up and down out of a trash can around the greens, their games are just better than ours. They're just better players.
I remember when Annika played in the PGA Tour event at Colonial in 2003, and on the third hole, the two guys that she's playing with were able to cut the dog leg, and they hit a drive and an 8-iron in, and she couldn't cut the dog leg. She hit a drive and a 7-wood inside their 8-iron. So, that's what they're up against. The other thing, too, that these stats show is that most of these guys don't hit the golf ball as far as they think they do, you know. Like, they think they hit a 280, and that's more like they hit a 240. And, they hit a 280 sometimes, you know, downhill, downwind. But their average drive, they found that the 0-5 handicaps, their average drive was about 239.
Ron, let's move to the Hall of Fame, and let's start with the inductees that were announced last month. There's a couple, one off the LPGA Tour and one that is just a name that I'm sort of incensed that it's taken this long to get in. Let's start with Peggy Kirkbell. If she just was responsible for pine needles in mid-pines, that's enough for me to put her in the World Golf Hall of Fame, because I'm in the tank for her and her family and what all they've done in the area in which I live and play a lot of golf. But sort of educate people what all Peggy Kirkbell was about.
Yeah, I've been lobbying for her for a long time, and back before they changed the selection process and I had a vote, I was a big advocate of her. Peggy Kirkbell was a pioneer as a player, as a teacher, and as a businesswoman. You know, that's three pretty important areas to make contributions to the game. She was there in the early days when the LPGA was formed. She was there in the early days when the LPGA Teaching and Club Pro Division was formed, and she created golf courses, resorts, businesses, facilities of her own that are highly successful and that are still hosting tournaments. She was a hugely significant person that for the life of me, I don't know why it took so long to getting around to getting her in there.
And isn't it, I mean, it's one of those names that everyone sitting around the room had to be going, yes, she deserves to get in there. Why? This happens way too often, Ron. Why do we wait until someone passes and then immediately put them in when you knew 10 years earlier they were going to get in, and let them enjoy the moment?
Yeah, we did that with Dan Jenkins was the first journalist who got into the World Golf Hall of Fame while he was still alive. You know, we put in the Bernard Darwins and the Herbert Warren Wins and stuff after they died. And the guy who was the chairman of our company, Golf Digest Company, in his lobbying effort to the World Golf Hall of Fame, said at the time, I think Dan was 87, I think he's 89. They just sort of said, come on, you know he's going to be in the Hall of Fame eventually. Let's get him in while he can enjoy the moment. And I do think that, on the selection committee for the World Golf Hall of Fame, I lobby very, very hard for the old-timers in the game, the McDonald Smiths and the Denny Shoots and those kind of people of the world, because I do think that we live in an age where if there isn't video of the person that exists, if ESPN doesn't have a highlight of them, we tend to devalue their accomplishments. And I think it's sort of part of the obligation of us old guys to remind people that that Tiger Woods didn't invent golf, that there was a whole lot of golf played before he came along.
Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com is our guest taking Dead Aim. While we're on that subject, and we'll get back to the current inductees in just a second, but you brought something up about the old timers, and it's something that I've been thinking a lot about, reconciling players from different eras and not by today's standards, sort of what you're bringing up. And a name that was bandied about this last time was Champagne Tony Lima. And I remember my dad talking about Tony Lima, and I looked him up because I really had no knowledge of him. I knew he was a major champion. But he had a run of 62 to 66 where he won 12 times and won major championship. And then he was tragically taken in an airplane accident. And how do we reconcile that on potential of what might have been? Is it similar to the way, even though Fred Couples had an accomplished career, I feel like a lot of his Hall of Fame was as good as he was. Think about what he might have been had his back not gotten hurt.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to factor in the what would have been thing in there. You know, in baseball, and as you know, I'm a big baseball fan. You know, if Thurman Munson hadn't died young, you know, would he have been eventually a Hall of Famer? But he didn't have enough years to do it. But you know, in a case like Tony Lima, I mean, I remember those time periods that you remember. That was I was 12 to 17 years old during Tony's run up there, and he was not only a really good golfer who was very successful. He was a showman. You know, he was got his name Champagne Tony because when he won a tournament, he'd buy champagne for the reporters in the media center. And boy, that was a way to make friends with the press.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, and so somebody makes contributions to the game that way. I mean, it's hard to factor in those intangibles. You know, one of the people who got into the Hall of Fame, Jan Stevenson, had a very, very good record as a player, but she also was off the charts in the intangible area. You know, what she did marketing women's golf was a huge part of her legacy and a huge part of her contribution to the game.
Thank you for bringing her back up, because she was next on the list. And it almost sounds sexist to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. Look, she was gorgeous. She was sexy. She not only had a great golf game, but she looked great. And you really have to take that into account as far as how she was able to boost the Q rating for the LPGA in her prime.
Yeah, and she marketed herself that way. You know, she was comfortable marketing herself as a sex symbol on tour, and that was the LPGA has spent 68 years living in the shadow of the PGA Tour, and it always needs to do whatever it can to get out from under that shadow and call attention to it, and Jan was very, very successful at you know, getting onto the cover of Sports Illustrated. You know. And you know, when she did something, it was the way in the early days of the LPGA. You know, Babe Zaharias wasn't one of the greatest women golfers of all time, and believe me, my old friend, the late Louise Suggs, would remind me that all the time. But the Babe was a marketer. The Babe knew how to sell, and that's really important, and it's particularly important when you're involved with a niche product trying to get the attention that it deserves.
Now, the one thing that I think about Jan Stevenson, the one thing that holds me back with her, and in a way, it kind of held me back with Dame Laura Davies, even though it's a weaker argument with her, is I think about the LPGA Hall of Fame, which is different from the World Golf Hall of Fame. And they are the Hall of Achievement. It is very cut and dried. When you look at the requirements, what it basically boils down to is 20 or 21 wins in two majors. If you can do that and be on tour for 10 years, that gets you in the LPGA Hall of Fame. And that's always been sort of my number to get in the World Golf Hall of Fame. If you've got 20 wins on tour and two majors, I just rubber stamp you. You are in. Stevenson had 16 wins and I think two majors or three majors. And so I'm kind of going, if she wasn't good enough for the LPGA Hall of Fame, is she good enough for the World Golf Hall of Fame? And it's somewhat ridiculous. Again, it's a weaker argument with Dame Laura Davies because she won something like 70 or 80 times around the world, 87 times around the world, and was a huge contributor to the game on an international level and with the Solheim Cup. So, you know, it's ridiculous that she's not in the LPGA Hall of Fame. But is there a happy medium? Is there a reconciliation between what the LPGA has as their requirements and the more subjectivity of the World Golf Hall of Fame?
Well, Dame Laura Davies would tell you that she likes the LPGA's qualifications better than she likes the World Golf Hall of Fame's, because she likes the fact that the LPGA has a very specific point system. It's 27 points. She has 25, so she needs either two more regular LPGA victories or one major championship to qualify for it. She doesn't like when people are voted in because and she's been offered to be made a member of the LPGA Hall of Fame as a lifetime achievement honorary thing, and she doesn't want it. She wants to earn her way in. You know, there are guys in the World Golf Hall of Fame, and I'm not going to mention any names, that I wouldn't have in. Guys who have one major, guys who have no majors.
I agree. You know? I agree.
And but I'm a tough grader. You know, I mean, I look at Retief Goosen, and he's borderline for me. You know, he won two U.S. Opens, and he won a bunch of tournaments. But I try to think if somebody was like, he was never the best player of his time, of a year, He was never, Freddie Couples was for a couple of years the best player in the world. Nick Price for a couple of years was the best player in the world. Curtis Strange was for a couple of years the best player in the world. But, there have been other players out there who win a lot of regular tour events and don't really have a great resume in the major championships, but they end up getting into the Hall of Fame, and I'm a tougher grader than they are in general.
Yeah, no, I am too. Like I said, I'm a 20-2 guy, and when I looked at Retief, I thought the same thing. He won 2 U.S. Opens. He won 7 times on the PGA Tour, 14 times on the European Tour. So, but that 7 times on the PGA Tour with 2 U.S. Opens really stands out to me. Look, there was a time when I thought I'd never see or had never seen a putter of U.S. Open greens like Retief Goosen. The guy, the year that he won at Shinnecock was one of the great underrated putting performances of all time.
Finished with 6-1 putts in a row.
Yeah. unbelievable. But, Ron, to me, the lasting memory in my head of Retief Goosen is how he absolutely, with the tournament on his clubs on Sunday in 2005 at Pinehurst, absolutely laid an egg. And just completely shot himself out of the tournament. And for all intents and purposes, that was the last we heard of Retief Goosen's name.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, too, is that I do think sustained greatness is should be something that's considered in there, too. How long can you go out there and be at the very top? You got to say, somebody like Ernie Els, who did it for more than 2 decades. I mean, that's really impressive. Phil Mickelson is off the charts that way. But you got somebody who is a really, really good player for a short period of time, maybe a half dozen years, and it wins a couple of majors, and I'm not entirely sure that those are Hall of Fame numbers.
No, I'm with you. There's a couple of names. I mean, I'm not sure about Tom Weisskopf. As much as he's got one of the prettiest swings I've ever seen, I remember a lot of Tom Weisskopf falling short. And, his numbers just aren't quite there. He reminds me a lot of David Duval. Numbers very similar. David had a couple of really great years, but he's not Hall of Fame to me.
Yeah, Duval won a major championship and then never won a tournament again. That's a stumbling block for me when you're evaluating his career.
So is it safe to say that because of the requirements of the LPGA that we have to be more subjective with some of the women players getting into the Hall of Fame than we do with the men or not?
Well, I don't think whether or not you're in the LPGA Hall of Fame is the most difficult Hall of Fame in all of sports to get into. And whether you're in there or not, Laura Davies to me is just a slam dunk, no-brain Hall of Famer because she won 20 times on the LPGA. She won 45 times on the Ladies European Tour. She won 87 times worldwide. She played on 12 Solheim Cup teams. She was the first non-American to lead the LPGA money list in 1994, was the LPGA Player of the Year in 96. She went out this year and won the U.S. Senior Women's Open, and she won the Senior LPGA Championship. And I was going through it, and the year that she joined the LPGA, 1992, 7 of the top 10 players on the women's rankings right now weren't born yet, and Laura finished second in the Bank of Hope Founders Cup this year. If she had won that tournament, she would have broken the record as for the oldest winner in the LPGA by 9 years. And Laura, in her heart of hearts, still thinks that she's going to get the 2 points she needs to get into the LPGA Hall of Fame. But I do think that it's important to bring intangibles in. Look, one of the people in the Hall of Fame who never won a major, Colin Montgomery, you got to ask yourself, winning 7 straight order of merits on the European Tour, yeah, man, you can't ignore that. And his Ryder Cup record is hugely important in determining his legacy. That's something that's grown enormously since 1985, what you do in the Ryder Cup. It's going to be a big part of Sergio Garcia's legacy and why he's going to get into the Hall of Fame with only one major. Lee Westwood may get into the Hall of Fame with no majors because of what he did on the European Tour and what he did in Ryder Cup play.
Get you out of here on this, back to our initial conversation. So if we have three loudmouth club scratch golfers against Laura Davies, you and I are both taking Davies, and she's given two aside, right?
Oh, my. I'll tell you, she still kills the ball. She was hitting two irons. You know, I was at French Lick for the Senior LPGA Championship.
Which is a tough course, by the way.
Oh, a really hard golf course, very hard golf course. And she shot under par 3 days in a row. And the first day might have been the worst, most miserable weather-wise day I've ever spent on a golf course. It was like 40 degrees drizzling with 25-mile-an-hour winds. Laura can still hit her 2-iron 240 off the tee, and she can hit the driver out there about 275, 280, and she's got around the greens. She reminds you a lot of John Daly, big, strong power hitter who's got really soft hands. Her touch around the greens is just phenomenal. It makes you wonder what she'd accomplished if she ever bothered to practice.
He is a past recipient of the PGA's Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism. That's Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com. And when we return, part one of a two-part conversation today with golf historian and Golf Channel broadcasting pioneer Peter Kessler as he takes dead aim not just at the World Golf Hall of Fame, but with his last poignant memory of Payne Stewart. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Hey, we're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. It's always a pleasure to get the thoughts and opinions of golf historian and Golf Channel broadcasting pioneer Peter Kessler. Peter, before we get to the Hall of Fame discussion, I wanted to bring up something that you tweeted out on Thursday afternoon, which was the anniversary of Payne Stewart's death. It was a poignant memory that really took me back. It was October 10th, 1999. You're sitting with Payne Stewart at the clubhouse at the old course. I assume this was for the Dunhill. Were you both there for that?
Well, it was the Dunhill Cup in those days, and that preceded the Dunhill Links by 2 years. And the Dunhill Cup was when three players from each country went over and played a series of very complicated scoring metrics, which was part stroke play, part match play. Yeah, so it's the Sunday of the Dunhill Cup, and Payne just finished his match. And he and I had been friends then since summer of 95, I'd say. You know, we played golf. I went to his charity outing. We'd had dinners. I'd been to his house. He wanted me to speak at something once, and Jake Trout and the Flounders, you know, the whole band came on and did my show with me. And so we had a, you know, really good relationship, and I really liked him a lot. And he finished his round, and he was supposed to come on TV with me a few weeks before, and he did something he was embarrassed about, and he thought I was going to, you know, give him a hard time about it, which I would have. And so he said, "So look, you know, I apologize about the TV thing, and he said, but you know, you live in Orlando." He said, "I live 5 minutes away." He said, "You know, so he said, I'll definitely be back in Orlando in November." He says, "I got to go do some things about my golf course next week, in a few weeks, and some other stuff." And he said, "Well, we can definitely play in November, and then let's do the show, and then we'll have dinner, and then I'll get drunk and watch you sit there like a weirdo." And he said, "And then we can go back to the house and hang out and do whatever." And he said, "You know, look, just remember, Peter, you know, we have all the time in the world." And then 2 weeks and 1 day later, I'm in Hawaii, some kind of an outing, and Roger Maltby is there, and Chi-Chi, and Stephen Stills was there, and some actresses and stuff, and Craig T. Nelson, the actor, and Scott Bakula, some other folks, and a collector kind of a group. And so it was early in the morning in Hawaii when the first news that there might be problems came out. So that's what we knew when we were on the range, because Chi-Chi came up and had some kind of a radio or something, and he said, something going on with Payne Stewart in an airplane. But we didn't know that it was bad news, just something wasn't quite right. So Maltby had a bad feeling, and he went back to his room, and he and Payne had just become friendly again, because what happened was Payne went through a thing where he went from nice guy to a little out of control to nice guy and discover God. And a lot of us went through that. I mean, you know, I got married really young, and I totally rebelled. It took me a while to figure out how to do it. Not everybody can just, like, do it. Not everybody has the training to do it, too. You know, my dad died when I was 20, so I didn't, like, know anything about being a dad, certainly, because we never discussed anything. I discussed a lot more of that with Arnold Palmer than I did, and Tommy Bolt, really, than I did with my own dad, because, you know, they lived so much longer, and they, you know, we kind of adopted each other. But Payne and I were fantastic friends, and that night, there was a dinner, and, you know, and it's Hawaii, so you can imagine it's beautiful, and we are right off the ocean, and there was a stage set up, and Stephen Stills had his guitar technician flown in from one of the other islands and got Stephen ready to do a mini concert, which he did. He probably played, I don't know, 6 or 8 songs, just him. It was absolutely fantastic. He probably had the best voice of the 4 guys,
right,
when it was Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, the actual best voice, and those guys thought that too. So Stephen says, okay, now I'm going to play Treetop Flyer, which was Payne's favorite song. And he said, and Payne loved to play harmonica to this song, and he thought he was like a +2, but he was definitely a 12. And so he plays Treetop Flyer, and as he's playing it, the moon rises to his right, and just over his right shoulder from where we're sitting in the audience, and it was a thrilling moment, even though that may seem like an odd word, because, you know, you almost felt like you saw Payne's spirit, like, going up into the sky, and he's playing Payne's favorite song, and it was a beautiful, beautiful evening, and you couldn't help but have, like, really good thoughts about Payne. It wasn't a somber affair, funnily enough. I mean, I think it was too soon, and you know, the normal series of reactions didn't have a chance to, you know, to kick in and follow one another, and so at this point, people were still stunned, but it turned into a kind of a magical moment and a great way for us to celebrate Payne's incredibly short and ultimately unfair life.
Do you think that because of that experience that kept, because when I read your tweet in the last line about we have all the time in the world, I would have been haunted by that last conversation I had with him. Do you think that experience in Hawaii helped you not be haunted by that?
Well, I mean, you know, it certainly provided some mini closure in a way, but certainly, you know, there are certain kinds of things that we know that just stay with you no matter what. There are some memories, there are some things that happen we can dismiss fairly quickly. There are some painful things that we eventually can dismiss with time, but there are also some things that pass those two particular specters, and they're indelibly imprinted in your core for the rest of your life. Everybody's had a few experiences where those are part of you now. So in no way at all did what he say diminish in its power over time, nor in the amazing irony of the timing of the comment, but never wasn't a haunting. It was a, you know what, I was glad it was me who he was talking to.
Peter Kessler, golf historian, our guest, Taking Dead Aim. All right, I've been thinking about this for quite a while. The genesis of this conversation was a back and forth between you and I on Twitter when the Hall of Fame inductees were announced. And before we get to what we're going to agree about, which is most of it, we're going to have to cover what I think you and I may disagree about, or what I know that you and I disagree about, and that is Billy Payne's induction into the World Golf Hall of Fame. And I see your points as to why he shouldn't be, and we'll get to those in a second. But let me make my argument as to why I think Billy Payne is worthy of being inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Okay.
First off, there's a lot of lips. I know you're licking your chops. I'm not doing anything.
I don't have any plans. I don't do it that way. I just see what happens. I'll take the next swing.
One of the great phrases that gets so much lip service and very little activity behind it is the phrase, let's grow the game. Grow the game of golf. Outside of the RNA and the USGA, I think I can make a pretty good argument that the most powerful voice in the game of golf right now is Augusta National Golf Club because of the Masters. In terms of growing the game, there are three things that Billy Payne has done or did during his tenure as president of the club, which are unprecedented as far as the three big voices in golf in terms of growing the game. First was drive, chip, and putt. This was nothing. This was just a pie-in-the-sky idea. It is now maxed out each year at 53,000 kids, 332 events across the country, with the finals being held at Augusta National the Sunday before Masters Week. It's televised. It's a huge deal for any kid between the age of 7 and 15. They all want to do this. It's sort of like getting the golden ticket to go to the chocolate factory in your Charlie bucket. It's incredible. So I think he's done that to grow the game. And the other two, which may be even more significant, are the Asia Pacific Amateur. Started that. The winner gets an automatic exemption into the Masters. That's given us Hideki Matsuyama twice. Curtis Luck won that as well before he won the U.S. Amateur. And the Latin American Amateur, also you get a pass into the Masters, but you do not get a pass into the Open Championship or the U.S. Open. You just get into the final qualifying stage. So in other words, he kind of upped the ante on the other two bodies of golf. And I think those three things in terms of growing the game of golf, when no one else has done squad douche, in my opinion, in the last 10 years, I think that makes him worthy of induction into the Hall. Now eat me alive.
Well, I would say to you, to give you the shortest answer, is if he had done, so that's three, if he had done 17 other things like that to get to 20, then I'm on board. But I'm sorry, that's just not significant enough. I mean, here's how it lays out for me. You know, if we could do the whole all over again, what I would say is, there's a few kinds of people you can have in. The minimum number of majors for a player is five. You want to be one of the greatest players of all time, you want to be in the Hall? Five. But if you didn't get to play in all four majors in your prime years, then you can be under consideration for three or four. So that's why you would put an old and young Tom Morris, for example, but Brad Taylor and Varden are already in because they have 5, 5, and 7. You know, and Jones, of course, in is with 13, and Sarah's with 7. So the great ones, you know, easily surpass that. But to me, 5 is the minimum number. Now, the other thing is you can put in people who have made a ridiculously enormous contribution to the game. So that would be like Charles Blair McDonald, the father of American golf. You know, he was from Chicago. He goes to the University of St. Andrews, plays with young and old Tom Morris, learns the game on the old course, comes back here, goes back there, spends several years studying the greatest courses of Great Britain, comes back here. 1908, he builds National Golf Links of America, which I played a couple of weeks ago, which was so beyond sensational. I'm stunned, and I had already played it once before. And he really is responsible for the start of the USGA, pretty much responsible for the start of the U.S. Amateur, the U.S. Open, golf course architecture in this country. He relies on the template of holes that he made at National Golf Links than any other source, including the old course at St. Andrew, as the place where you can go see holes and go, oh, I get that concept. Oh, I understand how the width works here. Oh, I understand how if I could pick the line I really wanted, I actually can't pick that line because he's got something there. So let's figure out the strategy. So every great golf course architect since 1908 has come there and has studied there, like taking your PhD. So to me, that's a qualifying event. So when you compare a figure like that to somebody who was the head of a club that didn't allow women in, has a reputation for being a racist, there are a lot of issues with the Olympic Games. The only women he let in were, you know, kind of famous women. It's not, you need Mrs. Joe Schmo. It's not about having the former Secretary of State. That doesn't count. That's tokenism. That's what we call tokenism. You know, you say, oh, okay, I did it. Yeah, but you picked the Queen of England to be the member. That doesn't count. It doesn't count. It's got to be somebody who works on the grounds. You know, it was originally both a commoner's game and a royal game, hence the naming of all the things that are royal in Great Britain, because royalty blessed those places, those fields of play, and Royal St. George's, Royal Troon. So it was played by the blacksmith, and so I have a problem with their exclusion policy and their pretense of being open. And for Billy Payne's tenure there, nothing changed. I have a real problem with that. I don't think he understands anything about golf courses, because he allowed the Hootie Johnson, Tom Fazio changes to remain. Bobby Jones didn't want clusters of trees. I mean, it was like reading the first page of the manual. And if Bobby and I were going to write it today, we would say, oh, and by the way, when you're building a golf course, if you're going to have trees, make sure they're not really in the line of play anywhere, and that they're much more on the perimeter. But if you do get in them, they have to be spaced far enough apart so you can always advance your shot, unless you're incredibly unlucky and can't make a swing or your ball is up against a tree. But he wanted you to have room to play the freaking shot. Phil Mickelson, the great six iron. The only reason he could hit the shot, as it turned out, was he had the room to hit the shot. He did not have to chip out. Jones did not like the clutter that forced you to play what was not a recovery shot, but a ball that you just had to put back in play that any 36 handicapper can chip sideways with a 7-iron. Jones didn't want you to do that. He wanted you to see if you can knock it on up there, regardless of the quality of your play. So I have a real problem that he didn't address that. And, of course, you know, the Masters is not a good example of golf in the sense that it's Disney World, and it's Disney World for 1 week out of the year, and the rest of it's like, you know, walking down the street, you know, the main street in your hometown. That's what real golf is like. You know, Augusta's only that way for just that very moment. You know, like catching a model at the most beautiful moment when she's 21 years old. She may never look that way again, or eventually she won't. But, you know, Augusta, they can go ahead and put the makeup on it and do the hair every single year. They have the people come in. So it's artificial, and as a result of that, there's a sense, very strong, that that's what your course is supposed to look like. That's what your course is supposed to play like, and it's not supposed to. And that's not the course that Bobby Jones designed to begin with. So Hootie's three events, Billy Payne's three events to me, I wouldn't have even had him on a list for consider. I give him out of 10, a 0.
Okay, so I guess we're not going to agree on Billy Payne. Up next, Peter Kessler continues to take dead aim at the Hall of Fame. Who does and does not deserve to get in, and why? Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We're taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And we continue with our World Golf Hall of Fame discussion and debate with golf historian and Golf Channel broadcasting pioneer Peter Kessler. One contributor that is getting into the Hall of Fame that I think you and I both agree on, and I think we both agree that it came way too late. Look, if Peggy Kirkbell just did Mid Pines and Pine Needles, that would have been enough for me. She contributed so much. You talk about a great contributor to the game of golf, Peggy Kirkbell. And this notion of not letting people in who you know are going to be in, and you don't let them in until they die. This is really something. I hate to use this word. It's starting to piss me off.
Well, it's It's so thoughtless. It's so offhand. It's with such a careless and wanton disregard for the game itself and for the great heroes of the game. And you know, if I could just be in charge for a day, I don't even think it would take me till lunchtime. I mean, you know, this, and you know, you raise a problem I haven't even thought about in great detail, but I already know the answer, and I know that what I'm going to say is going to absolutely be correct. So, if you're a major contributor to golf, other than as a golfer, by which at the age of 50 you've done the stuff that you're going to do, so 50 is a reasonable number. But if your contributions are a melded thing, like starting the beginning of the LPGA, she was there for that. And we know all of the incredible things she did. And by the way, I said on Twitter the other day when Ron Cyrak said, gee, we'll get three low-digit handicappers to play against some LPGA players, see how that goes. When Peggy Kirk-Bell was 75 years old, I was a 4. She gave me 2 shots at Pine Needles. 2 shots. She gave me 2 shots. At one stretch, she was 4 under through a 7-hole stretch, because in the middle of it, she went birdie from a foot and a half, eagle from a foot after hitting a brassy to the par 5.
Nice.
And she didn't have to putt, and I would have made my grandmother putt. And then the one she hit that the next hole was so close to the hole that you couldn't even see the grass between the ball and the cup. She beat me to a pulp. She was 75 years old. I shot 75. I was a 4. She gave me 2 shots. Are you insane? There's no such thing as any of this. So when you have a Peggy Kirk-Bell, who then by the age of 50 or 70 has, in her own way, completed the requirements to pass this examination, you put her in then. As soon as you know they've accumulated enough, you put them in. So at 50, we put in the golfers. At Charles Blair McDonald, 50 or 60, would have certainly put him in. Some of the writers we would have certainly put in at that point. So it's totally common sense. And I know I'm not going to think of a better answer later. It's when it's obvious that the major contributions of your body of work have been completed, you go in and you get to enjoy it. And you get to enjoy it for 25 freaking years. You know, Curtis wrote, you know, well, she's happy now. She's in the Hall of Fame. But she's not happy. She's in heaven. She's not anything. There's no TV. There's no ceremony. There's no anything. There's no recognition. You should leave the committee immediately tonight. You people have no forethought. You're careless. You have absolutely no sense of what it means to honor the most important people and the most important events in the game of golf. I lost a job for putting the game above my, you know, father figure, basically Arnold Palmer. I go, do I just get Arnold out of this, or do I do what I'm supposed to do? And it's the game that's most important. When he's above the game, and you have to care about it in that way. So, yes, when the body of work is obviously completed to the degree where you should be in, you're in. And there you go.
Your qualifications for the Hall of Fame are even more stringent than mine, and I thought I was being a hard you-know-what. I've always said, look, it's 20 wins on the PGA Tour, it's 2 majors before you're even in the conversation. And, you know, let's face it, it's gone from, in my opinion, the Hall of Achievement, which I think it should be, to the Hall of, well, he was a pretty good player and he was a really nice guy.
That's where we are.
And because that's where we are, we're starting to see names bandied about as to who should get in and who shouldn't. And I want to get your thoughts on just a couple of people before we get out of here. One is Tom Weisskopf. And look, there was never a sweeter-looking golf swing than Tom Weisskopf. He won one major, won about 16 times on the PGA Tour. But to me, I'm more remembered by him not being able to elevate his game in his era. And I think he's a really good player. I think he's David Duvall. I think he's a really good player. He's not in the Hall of Fame. And he's going to get in.
Well, he has to get in now. I mean, remember, the standards have changed. So as the standards change, you widen, you know, the net, and you accept more fish out of the sea, and some aren't exactly the prize catch. And so, you know, if you've got Freddie in with 15 and one major, well, Weisskopf is certainly a better player than Freddie Couples, no question about it. As great as Freddie Couples could play, Tom Weisskopf was a more complete player, and you know, and he had the great finishes at the Masters and stuff, but he's at 15 or 16 and won, you know, and he won like 8 gadillion times in 1973. He had his big year. And like a lot of guys at that time who had a big year, somehow, even though there wasn't much money around, they found it hard to sustain the motivation. That's why it's hard to be a great player. Because a great player means you do it for a period of time. That's why Brooks Koepka, if he retires tomorrow, he gets a no vote. You don't go into the Hall of Fame based on a 15-month career. I'm sorry, that's not how you make the judgment. So under my new rules, he has to get to 5 anyway, so I'm not even thinking about him. But under existing rules, they're going to put him in if he decides to go be a mechanic tomorrow because he's got 3 majors, and I'll bet I could take a pretty good guess. 45 to 50 guys probably have 3 majors or more is probably right. And so, you know, everybody who's got 3 or more, I believe, is in. So, you know, but certainly, you know, if Freddie Couples is in, Tom Weisskopf is in, you know, in a heartbeat, and he's made a much bigger contribution to the game. He's a really super architect. He's done some nice things in outs. He's not real good at it. I need to talk to him about it because I can help him fix it up a little bit. I know what he's not thinking to do. It's not automatic. It doesn't fall out of the sky. People think you can be a writer and then tomorrow you can be on television. It doesn't work that way. Jaime Diaz, one of the great, thoughtful, and introspective writers. You sit in a dark room and you work at it for weeks and weeks and you bang out the article. You can't then just go do that and now you're commenting on the green reading books that the USGA is now, you know, reapproving in some other fashion as a quick soundbite on television. The camera doesn't like him. He shouldn't be on TV. He doesn't have any of the skill set. It doesn't fall out of the sky. You know how long I worked, how hard I worked to make sure that I was able to pull together the skill set so that I could do the things that I do on TV, the things that you did to prepare to become the radio star that you are, the interviewer that you are, the research that you do on your subject, the way that you're prepared every single week. You're a professional. I'm a professional. It doesn't fall out of the sky.
Get you out of here on this. You brought up Fred Couples a number of times, and I really look. Freddie had a career that I think led him in the Hall of Fame on what I call Sandy Koufax of what might have been. Koufax had, you know, a magical run of about 5 or 6 years. Gale Sayers, same thing, had a magical run in the NFL of just a few years, and they were led in the Hall of Fame on what might have been had they hung around.
No way. Sandy Koufax and Fred Couples is like somebody who's learning to go play, get to take his first guitar lesson, Fred Couples. And Sandy Koufax is the freaking beast.
Well, no, I'm not comparing them in terms of skill level. I'm comparing them on terms of, you know, Koufax did not have the 15-year career.
You don't have to do that as a pitcher. He did it for 5 or 7 years. He did it in the toughest situations. He won major after major after major after major until he couldn't play anymore. What could have been was he could have kept it going. Fred Couples could, in his wildest dreams, never had 2 weeks like Sandy Koufax had 2 days in his whole career. It's not even close. Sandy Koufax is an automatic. It was terminated by injury. There was nothing about it. He wasn't showing promise anymore. He was the dude. My dad took me to Yankee Stadium. I saw that game when I was a boy. We sat right on the first baseline. He struck out 15 Yankees. Tom Tresh hit a 2-run homer. Dodgers won 15-2. It was the most incredible thing I ever saw. If that doesn't put you in the Hall of Fame, if that's not a major championship winning game after game after game in the World Series, blowing them away as though it were 48-0 in a football game. Hell, 48-0, 75-0. He's in. Freddie Couples may get to go stand in the standing room only behind the bleachers.
Okay. The point I'm trying to get to is this, and the name I was trying to get to is this. I was one of my father's favorite golfers that he would bring up the name from time to time, but that I was unaware of, was Champagne Tony Lima. And Lima had a run of 62 to 66. He won 12 times during that period on the PGA Tour and won one major. And then his life was cut short by a tragic plane accident. How do we reconcile someone like a Tony Lima in terms of the Hall of Fame, or do we?
Oh, no, he goes in now for sure, because now that the standards have completely changed and it's like, you know, cool people who've done interesting things and, you know, and again, maybe it could have been this if this had happened and, you know, and Chi-Chi's in with 8 wins. What the hell's that about? I mean, that toupee, you should see that sucker in person like a dead squirrel. No, today, for sure, under today's standards, you let him in because now you're allowed to with the expanded, you know, eligibility, you know, requirements. Yeah, now you're allowed to say what could have been. Now you can say what could have been on Tony Lima with the one major. Remember, you know, he wanted St. Andrews in 64. Arnold didn't play that year. Chip Anderson, Arnold's caddy, caddied for Lima. And Lima had an incredible, and that's why most tournaments are. Usually, a great player will tell you, it was this burst of holes over the 72 holes. You know, there was this 12-hole burst, right. 6-hole burst. That's what did it for me and stuff. And Lima had a couple of those in the Open Championship that year. Then, you know, and the real story, Charlie, is that, you know, he agreed to do an outing. And they were going to pick him up in a private plane. And then somebody else came to him and offered him more money for the same night, for an outing. Same deal with a plane. He blew off the first offer. Friend of his on tour, who for some reason I can't remember, somebody on tour heard the conversations and said to Tony, you should always honor your first commitment. You never do what you just did. And Tony got into the second private plane. And of course, he never got out of it alive. And so the irony of that is particularly stunning. But certainly, Tony was in his early 30s. I actually watched him win when I was a boy in Upper Montclair or Westchester Country Club. I think it was Westchester Country Club, 63, 64, 65, somewhere in there. And but yes, putting all of today's criteria in front of you, yes, of course, you would put Tony Lima in.
Okay, so maybe my Koufax analogy wasn't the best idea. Gosh, I sure love talking with golf historian and Golf Channel broadcasting pioneer Peter Kessler. Hey, I'd also like to thank Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com for his time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered this week, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great way to stay in the loop with us is to be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there right now are articles on Michael Jordan's new golf shoes, the amazing resort that is Bandon Dunes, and all the details about Tiger and Phil's upcoming pay-per-view match Thanksgiving weekend. Hey, weather-wise, fall has finally arrived in the Queen City, so layer up, get your golf on. And if you do, put a tee in the ground and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. Remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golf guy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.